Welcome to the F3, Female Forward Finance. I'm your host, Jill Faraday Lloyd, a financial advisor at UBS Private Wealth, and I'm on a mission to help women have agency with their capital. The F3 is a space for real conversations about money, power, and everything in between. You'll hear from experts, entrepreneurs, and everyday Janes about the choices they're making when it comes to their wealth. These are critical conversations because women are earning, building, and shaping what comes next in the world, and it's time we own every bit of our power. Welcome back to the F3. In this episode, we'll explore the journey of Gwen Whiting, the co-founder of The Laundress and founder of The Fill, as she shares the unfiltered truth about life before, during, and after a major exit. Learn how she protected her equity and legacy, and discover why bootstrapping was the key to her success. In this episode, you'll gain insights on how knowing your number before you sell can lead to millions more in your pocket. Let's dive in. Today, I'm thrilled to have Gwen Whiting as my guest. We're going to talk about how to protect yourself and your interests as a founder. Gwen is perhaps best known for founding her category-creating premium, eco-friendly laundry and home cleaning brand, The Laundress. Over the course of 17 years, she led the growth of her bootstrapped company to become a household name, and through its global expansion and eventual reported 9-digit acquisition by Unilever in 2019. In June of 24, with a renewed mission and a sense of purpose, Gwen launched The Fill, a collection of wellness-forward, aromatherapy-infused laundry, home cleaning, and fabric care solutions sold exclusively to members of the brand's private cleaning club. I'm excited to have Gwen here to share insights from her 20-plus year as an entrepreneur, advisor, and confidant. Her insights are shaped by what she learned, hears, and knows, revealing truths that often go unspoken. Let's begin. Welcome, Gwen.
Hi, Jill.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here, too. It's such a joy to talk with friends.
I know. And in person. It's a rare podcast opportunity.
Thank you. I would love to work backwards from where we are today. And congratulations on your successful exit. It's not every day that somebody survives and makes it to the other end and actually starts a new gig. So are you enjoying life today?
That's a complicated question. It is the storybook ending. It's the storybook that everyone aspires for, hopes for, and few people get. So that is exciting, but it's not all rosy or isn't what it seems to cross the finish line and then figure out what's next. I had a 5-year non-compete. I had a contract to stay on with the company for 2 years. So that kind of kept me kind of cruising and operating normal business mode. And then the end. And the end corresponded with COVID. So while everyone's life was upended as well, the hardest part for me was sitting in nothing and creating space from me as the laundress and my past life and 20 years of that life to holding space for nothing in order to make a transition to the future.
To your what's next.
To what's next.
Yeah. I remember spending time with you when you were ideating on what could be your what's next.
Yeah. And it was so painful. It's like, you know, when someone dies or divorce or whatnot, they say, don't make any rash decisions. And so just sitting there and not making...
With the world. Standstill.
Right,
too.
Right. Creating that space, which had to happen. But, you know, kind of being disciplined to say no. I gave a lot of my time away in mentoring. But you're trying to fulfill this, or for me, I have a very strong creative energy. I have a social energy. I was used to high pace building, creating, and working with my teams. And that was the fun energy that I enjoyed and that I missed and I had a hole for.
Mm. Yeah. So one of the things I talked often with founders about is, the three legs of the stool. You want to maximize the saleable value of your business, you want to maximize your personal financial wealth, and you want to think about your what's next on the other end. So here you are in COVID, and you've got this great big hole, and you decide to fill it.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun.
Well,
let's go.
I filled it, not how I would have liked to, unfortunately. I watched my acquirer, Unilever, with the beautiful, I sold them an incredibly pristine business, very profitable, and there was a real path for the future, for growth, and what was going to happen to the brand under their leadership, which is why I sold to them, because I thought they had the wherewithal to take the brand to the next level, which was, empowering and making more people around the world happy with what I made. And they ignored the plan and just completely arrogantly and irresponsibly trashed my company. Mm-hmm. So it was a very public trashing of the company, and I ended up exercising my non-compete when it expired 5 years later.
And created the fill.
So the fill was fulfilling the promise and what I of helping people for all those years. I was unwilling to leave this entire customer base that I fulfilled, that I created solutions for.
You created, and
people relied on what I made for all those years. A little bit further than like losing your favorite lipstick color. Mm. It's like trusting your, what you clean your house and your clothing with. So that's why I stepped back into the laundry room to get back into business. But it was also fulfilling my legacy. It was very difficult to spend my 20 years of my life completely dedicated to something and then have that disappear. So there's a twofold in that aspect.
There's a lot of laundry fold.
Yeah, there's no shortage of laundry punnage.
I know that it was an incredible ride to build the laundress and to ultimately sell her. If you're okay, I'd love to talk a little bit about the messy middle of running the laundress, because while it was your life's passion, there were, from what you've shared with me, a lot of challenges mm-hmm. that weren't just at the exit, but occurred during the life of the laundress.
Sure.
And, for our listeners who are growing their businesses, I'd really love you to be sort of the person who says, what I wish I knew, but nobody told me.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you want to begin with that?
Where to start? So the laundress was my baby. I birthed her in 2002. Mm. I launched her in 2004, and I nurtured her throughout the whole time. I brought in a friend from college as a business partner. And naively, I just assigned a 50-50 partnership, assuming that we shared the same values and work ethic and passion and desire and drive to build this together. That was it. That's just what I believed. And that was, that comes with consequences. It's a very serious decision to have a partner. There's a lot of people ask me about partnership and doing it alone and all the different ways, and there's pros and cons. It's really tough. You are in a marriage with no divorce. It is easier to get divorced in the state of New York or any other state or any other country, because there's rules and protocol and process. That doesn't exist in a business partnership. You can write a shareholder agreement just like you can write a post-nup or whatever, but they're incredibly hard to enforce, and if you do, it's expensive. So that's just the reality. And so very early on, I went to a very early female founder event. This was like around 2006. Like, it was unheard of. It was the first women who were talking about this, and their platform was called, it's not even a platform. In 2006, it was like, I don't know, there was a conference and a book. Maybe a website, unclear. And they were called Ladies Who Launch. And I went to this seminar with my partner, and Kathleen King spoke, and Kathleen had just lost Kathleen's bakery. And she lost her name, she lost her bakery, she lost her company to a quote partner that she brought in. She had $250,000 in debt and had her house on the market to live. And she told that story, and I sat in the audience, and from that day on I realized for my entire rest of my laundress career, all I had to do was defend my 50%. Kathleen
protect half a baby.
Half my baby. That's all I had. That was my nest egg. That was, I put everything into it. That was my ride or die. Like, I left my job that I loved because I believed I had better earning potential on my own than I did at Ralph Lauren, at a great company. I love my job. I love my coworkers. I love my boss, but the earning potential structure was a structure. You know, the sort of Ralph Lauren way. I either had to marry myself off, probably to a banker, you know, or, you know, subscribe to being stuck in that structure. So I went for it.
You bet on yourself.
I bet on myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about this partnership.
Well, we'll give the happy ending to Kathleen. She then started Tate's Cookies and had a wonderful second chapter, but with a different mission and a very clear view on what she needed to do to protect herself.
So. And I love Tate's because they make gluten-free chocolate cookies.
Exactly.
That's amazing. So the 50-50 structure, was there any way that you were clearly doing most of the work?
I was carrying a big load.
Yeah.
And from the beginning and to the end. Mm-hmm. So what I realized very quickly in my defense of my 50 was I basically, after having some investor meetings and private equity and blah, 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 realizing if I let anyone in the door and giving up any percentage of mine, that I would be susceptible to being thrown under the bus. Period, end of story. And there were very early examples of that. There were other founders who, with this woman who started Aiden and A, this baby swaddles, she actually loved her investors so much, we met with them, and then within the year, she was fired from her own company. There was another, Serena and Lily, another example where two partners took in money, and one partner got thrown out, and the other one stayed. So this is a reoccurring business model.
Yeah.
And I knew that I would be the one that would get thrown under. I knew it. So the moral of the story is I couldn't let anyone in my house.
And what about hiring an attorney to restructure the business?
You're just paying to fight. And I knew that it would be like the death of the company. So it was like, grin, bear it, and like hang on.
What are some of the tricks that you said to yourself to get through those really dark moments of, I just have to protect myself, I just have to, what were some of the things you did specifically to protect yourself during those years?
I mean, it was a long journey, like obviously antidepressants. It was impossible. It was grueling. I say I'm a masochist. I was a child gymnast. I grew up in a leotard, so I was used to humiliation and pain. It's funny, but it's true. So to be able to put yourself through that much long-term grind, grit, and pain, I was a bit prepped for it as a child. But I just had my and I wasn't counting the days to an acquisition. I really wasn't. I loved fundamentally what I did. I loved the doing. I loved the creating. I loved the reward of customer feedback and hearing from someone that they got a stain out or how much they love something, or, you know, just the pure joy and enthusiasm for what I was doing for people. That was like my everyday joy.
So that's what got you out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
In spite of that. So we are working backwards here. We went from the sale to the messy middle. Let's talk about fundraising, right? You bootstrapped the Laundress. What advice would you give founders about raising outside capital, besides the risk that you talked about with private equity and perhaps losing your role?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is I didn't raise partially because I felt insecure that I didn't know how or what or the finances behind the, like, every time you ask someone about a deal, oh, it depends. You know, there was no clear answers.
There's no structure.
There's no structure. You know, everything's different, whatever, whatever. And I also felt that when I did take a few of those meetings, then it's like, oh, we'll make you to 10X and you'll get this and all this fairy tale and pipe dream and nonsense. I knew that, like, I knew my business better than anyone else. And I knew what it would take to get to certain benchmarks, which necessarily weren't 10X. And how is this guy, who never did a load of laundry, like, going to do that for me? You know, and it was like this, oh, we do this, we do that, you know, nonsense. And I was like, really? I'd love to see how exactly does that happen? And so it was just...
So you did know the numbers.
I knew my numbers, but the irony, Jill, is that I never did this. I didn't even know what a cap table was until after I sold the company. I was talking to a founder, and she's telling me about our cap table, and I was like, oh, what's that? But I never went through the raise. So I felt safer raising myself. Again, it was what I can do for myself. And I started the company with an SBA loan, $100,000. I filled out all the papers. I went to the SBA office. I worked with an advisor for a year. Like, I put the work in. This isn't like, I had a 30-page business plan. Today, the kids these days, you know, it's like a 2-page slide and go ask for money. Like, that's not how you build a responsible business. Like, completely thought out. I followed that business plan to a T. And it was a complete masterpiece. I had my entire roadmap in front of me, and all I did year over year was fill in the numbers for everything that happened that year, and then the next on the list that I accomplished in the next edition, and followed that map. But aside from the SBA, which $100,000 goes very quickly, especially in an inventory-based business, then I got envelopes in the mail every day or every week from a credit card company. And in 2004, if you filled them out, they actually sent you a credit card with a line of credit on it. And that happened until 2008.
Yep.
Which, shocking, there was a financial crisis because every credit card kept giving credit to an idiot like me who filled out the paperwork. And rolling over and 0% APR. And I had every credit card you could imagine to free monogramming at L.L. Bean. But that's how I financed. And after 2008, I had a profitable company. I mean, it had to be profitable early on, like at least making ends meet and a responsible building company that then we were able to get a bank line and loan. And that is how I was able to have access to money and not lose my 50% and not let anyone in the door who was going to make decisions on my behalf, because a Chase Bank loan officer isn't doing that to you.
Yeah, because raising money devalues your own stake.
Devalues your stake, and it lets someone in the door who has an opinion.
Right.
And then it creates a structure that's not one against one. It can easily be two against one.
Let's stay on this topic for a little while. I loved when we had dinner the other night, you were telling me about the lady in Westchester.
Mm. I talk to a lot of ladies. I think I'm sort of joking when I say I've become a bit of a exit doula or a female business owner doula. I have had a lot of conversations with other women, some who all exited, raised too much money, raised money that they were told was in the norm. And it's all, oh yeah, this is totally standard in the normal range, and completely overraised, which devalued their share and their exit and their takeaway mm-hmm. from their hard-earned work and dedication of their life. 10 years of your life dedicated to a result that you can't live off of. I'm not saying that it has to be a certain amount of money, but I think the whole point of putting yourself through this experience is to at least walk out the end with agency over your choice and the ability to choose how you want to spend your time.
If we go back to those three legs of the stool, it's maximizing your financial position, right? And so understanding what your number is.
Right. And if you know that your exit amount is going to be a certain amount that can't carry you or you can't live off of, then you should be well aware that you need to position yourself for the next employment,
job.
For the next job, yeah. or the next paycheck of sorts.
Right.
But to go through this expecting one outcome and having a different one is what I'm seeing a lot of, incredible disappointment and surprise, frankly, that is what happened. So the person I was telling you about in Westchester, I actually knew these founders since their very inception point, as I was a reference, and I know the business. I have a basic understanding of the size and scale and potential, and I think they would be incredibly lucky to have the deal that I got. I don't expect that actually to happen, but I walked her through the numbers of, if you had my deal, this is what it would mean to you. And she doesn't have the 50%. And I walked through the numbers and I was like, and this is what, you're lucky if you clear this at the end of the day and you've got two little kids and like private school and college ahead of you and like that isn't going to
butter your bread.
That's not going to carry you.
Yeah.
And it was a real reality check for her. And I'm clearly not a math genius. I'm just laying out the facts and the reality, because I think I think it's like birthing a child where you like forget all the terrible parts like on purpose. Your body's wired for that, and so you're in this drive of like go, but you kind of are wired to like not really comprehend the reality.
Yeah,
you're just doing
as opposed to planning and executing on a goal.
Yeah, and it's like, I want that deal, or I want that outcome,
well,
or
I
want,
but
it's like,
mean?
But yeah, and is that right. truly realistic?
Right. So I use very easy math, if you're not a math genius, but you are a founder, and you're
I can do napkin math like no other.
And you know that you own X percent of the company, and if you sell at this price, I usually talk to women and say, okay, let's say you net $10 million, and you invest that $10 million to live off of, and you get a 6% return. and you pay 1% in fees and 1% in taxes, mm-hmm. that's 4%. Can you live on $400,000 a year?
Right. Well, that brings to the point, which is having a small business and a sustainable business, and are you better off running that company, loving what you do, being profitable, making money, and I'm sure your salary is more than $400,000 a year.
Right.
So that's where you go into the math, right? It's mm-hmm. like, because if that's your end game number, what's your current number and what looks more attractive? So, and that's where I am now is in my second mountain journey. I obviously had the first mountain. I am grateful and lucky that I had the win. But the reality of the winners is the reality of having a business that's profitable, you're paid well, and you love it. And what your earning capacity, and if you're making that money and investing it, you know, year over year, and you're building your asset for a bigger nest egg and for a bigger number when you're, you know, when that time comes, at the end of the day, you're better off. But if you sign up for money early on, you don't have the luxury of that path.
Correct.
You've already signed up that you have a short window, you sprint, you gave up, and you better get a bigger number at the end because you already know that you've given your work away.
Yeah. We have a program at UBS called Project Female Founder, and it's an accelerator program for female founders who are raising Series A capital. And the whole gist of it is around knowing how to raise aligned capital, mm-hmm. and not just capital at all costs. Like capital that makes sense to you, and that could be grant funding, and that could be revenue. Mm-hmm. Like revenue is your best source of funding because mm-hmm. you're not giving anything away. So I really...
Or go as far as you can until you take that money, because then you're giving less away. And you really know what you're going to spend it on. And it's like you're a lot more calculated, and you understand really what that money will take you and what is worth spending on, because mm. you've already started off, and you're deliberately making choices of what is my best return, and then you have a much clearer idea if you do take that aligned capital later on.
And a smaller amount.
Smaller amount.
Yeah.
You know exactly what you're going to put it to work for. Hopefully you can actualize that return.
I got a giggle out of what you call a serial entrepreneur. Now, I don't think you're in that camp, but let's talk about the joke.
Yes, I am certainly not in that camp. I am not looking to build another giant CPG brand. I'm actually, my business model is almost like try and not make as much any money, I guess. Doing it through a private members club. But I have... In all these conversations and watching what's going on, my definition for a serial entrepreneur, and this isn't 100%, but I'd say it's a majority, is that it's the founder who exited who needs a paycheck, and they're looking for their next deal, and it happens right away, and it's when you're hot and when you still have your, you know, people knocking on your door and maybe previous investors, and you got to put together another revolutionary brand, or, you know, that you're reinventing something as your next gig, and you're raising money because you need another paycheck.
Mm. So it's serial because it's a job.
You need a job.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of these people have the really sexy headlines. But they raised so much money, and you can do the math. I mean, now it's kind of fun. There are these people on Instagram who are doing really great calculations of the reality. It's fun to see actually people breaking down the math publicly yeah. for people to really understand.
Well, that's the role that somebody like a financial advisor plays.
Sure.
Right? So we can help.
Yeah, hopefully you have that in your team ahead of time.
House.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like when an offer does come across the table, how to structure that. How much cash? How much carry? How much, you know, are you going to roll? How many years do you have to stick around?
Mm-hmm.
And modeling out all those different options, but also helping a founder understand truly how they can achieve the goals that they've set for themselves, and maybe they need to stay in the game another 4 years.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're better off doing that and, you know, earning your salary and doing wise things with that.
I work with a lot of VCs who send founders to me to help them do that very thing. And anecdotally, what we've found is that the founders who do their personal financial planning prior to signing an LOI, they actually end up making more money for themselves and their investors because they know what their number is. Mm-hmm. And they stay in the game longer so that they can get there. That real clarity of mind as to how to achieve that real exit, right, where you are not the quote-unquote serial entrepreneur that needs the job.
Yeah.
Well, I've always admired your discipline, bootstrapping your business, not giving away the house. What advice do you have for founders looking at the other side of an exit? Right? So I remember you telling me that you didn't plan to live some ridiculously fancy life. Let's talk about you, my fellow girl from New Jersey.
Yeah, I think it all goes into this sort of rainbow and lollipop idea of the headline and the numbers and then the reality. And, you know, the day the press release goes out, you get 57 emails from every banker in the U.S. looking for to help you. I also thought it was interesting that I also got emails from the private jet companies watching the wires. But the reality is, like, what you can afford, and can you sign up for the private jet company, eh? And where are you going? But, yeah, just I think, you know, I live a wonderful life, but I didn't, like, you know, upgrade to a house on the beach. You know, I kept my original house. And, you know, I have the luxury to that affords me to do what I want and feel comfortable. But it's like winning the lotto. Like, it's finite. You know, if you're not responsible with what you have, it can go. And it goes quickly. So there is a further responsibility and discipline and reality of what you have and how you manage that.
So what's next for you?
I really understand where I am now, and it's the second mountain journey, where the first mountain was I had to get to the top at all expense and fight and grills like climbing Everest. But now I walked down it, took a while, and found my second mountain. And what that means to me is really doing what I want, for and it's fun and it's fulfilling, which part of that is through the platform of The Fill. And what I didn't, I went through, it was interesting, I was thinking about this afternoon before I came here, was I started The film and my father said to me in August that he was out of soap. And he was in the hospital, and I think he was, like, deranged when he said it. And so I took that as a real sign of, like, why is he telling me he's out of soap? He's never once asked for soap from me in, like, all of these years. And I had the privilege and honor of going through a year, effectively a year of his dying journey, while I was deciding to go back into the laundry room, build The Fill, and what that meant to me. And so much of that is intertwined in watching and seeing a legacy and really understanding through the closing of his life how I want to look back on mine. So this was very much a thing I needed to do for my own personal legacy. It was something I needed to do to feel good about putting my products out in the universe. But how I'm doing it and why I'm doing it is completely different. Small business, it's as small as possible. It's not the things I don't want to do. I don't want to give money to Meta. I don't want to deal with Amazon. Like, all of the things that I had to do on the first mountain, I don't need to do. I'm not going to do it. And being imaginative and creative to do other things and other revenue avenues and all fun is a great challenge.
Another life experience.
Another life.
Right?
Yeah, so that's the business side. What I didn't actually calculate getting back into the laundry room was that I was going to start getting the invitations again and opportunities to speak, and the Phil's really provided me literally the soapbox to stand on so I can have these conversations. And that's what's empowering and exciting to me, is being able to tell the truth and the reality and hopefully help some people and inspire some people and maybe be a Kathleen King for someone else, who she was for me. And I have a lot to say, and I've learned a lot, and I speak to a lot of people, and I realize that a lot of people feel shamed in telling their own stories, but I have the ability to do it privately but publicly, and hopefully empower other people to protect themselves and have better upsides.
Well, thank you for all that you share with the world, Gwen. It's just such a inspiration to hear your story, to know you, and to see what you're doing in the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
Where can folks learn a little bit more about your work these days?
So my website is gwenwhiting.com. My Phil is thephilclub.com, and I'm not big on social media, but I guess I'm most active on LinkedIn.
Well, will you take connections on LinkedIn?
Oh, yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Gwen, for joining me today, and thank you, all you listeners. If you're a female founder looking to educate yourself on the exit process, please reach out to me at jill.lloyd@ubs.com. Join my mailing list, the F3, and then let's continue to make change in the world. Let's help each other. Best wishes to you all. Onward.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.